Hello, everyone. Welcome. We have an extremely special guest, Aaron Levy, the CEO and co-founder of Box. Really excited for you to be here. Thank you for coming on, and I'm sure that you're as excited to be here as we are as you.
Totally. Let's talk about some fun.
Yeah. So I wanted to. I that's great. I actually wanted to bring up maybe a memory, or maybe a memory you don't remember, is when I was in the days of starting ship that we had dinner. I think it was in Palo Alto, and you took me out to dinner, and I just wanted to kind of like, well, obviously, thank you for that. Like at that time, like
Sure.
Box was still like killing it, and like. Just like show other founders, like our listener base is first time founders mostly, and like the second time founders and third time founders and everybody is really like other founders that have given me time. Drew Houston from Dropbox, Brian Chesky, I probably spent like I don't know like 8 or 9 meetings with him when I was like a nobody of coming up. And so that's just a really interesting thing that I don't think happens as much. But kind of just thank you for that.
Now
Hope.
you have to use their intro link to book other founders and you have to pay for it.
Right.
Used to be you could get that kind of advice for free.
We figured out how to monetize our time better. So that's just this is just late
Yes.
stage capitalism in the mentorship land.
Why shouldn't I get $500 for walking my dog?
So I wanted to start off with just like one question, and then it's really like a free for all. So my dream is to eventually become a public company CEO. What would you recommend
That's literally
or
your
get?
dream.
Yes,
It's insane.
I am
Change
like
your
you.
dreams. Change your
I am
dreams.
like you. Like that's
Yeah.
my professional dream.
I see.
Can you give me some advice?
I mean, I would definitely modify your dreams. It's not anything that it's cracked up to me. But I mean, I would say the biggest, I mean, change of being public versus private is just your shareholder base changes. And there's a sort of a scoreboard, much more frequently updated. But other than that, I mean, it's all the same grind that we all deal with on the company building front. With just an order of magnitude more, transparency and sort of externally driven pressure on your results. And every single day, you're kind of on the clock. But I mean, I certainly, enjoy it, and I wouldn't want it any other way. But it's definitely a grind.
If you could think back to like when you so you've now been at Box 15 years,
18,
think
yeah.
18 years.
Yeah,
Okay,
time flies.
so
Exactly.
all right, if you can like think back to like a lot of those learnings, especially for the first time founders that we have listening here, like what are some of those, maybe some like interesting like anecdotes or just like times in the company it didn't go right and you were just like holy shit, like the company's gonna go out of business, or just like kind of just sharing like maybe some war stories as you were kind of coming up with Box.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're always sort of feeling this sort of existential dread at all times. And I mean, frankly, even to this day. But fortunately, it's a it it the pain and stress level of it is a little bit different. But when you're in the early stages, I mean, every single decision could be the make or break decision of the entire company. I mean, a business model shift, a key employee leaving, a funding round that doesn't close. And so in those early stages, we had one of everything that could have gone wrong, kind of went wrong. And I think the biggest things that I look back on. So our probably our biggest our most fundamental decision was our early pivot to focusing on the enterprise market when we had started, not necessarily as a consumer company, but we started sort of agnostic to who the customer was. It could be a consumer, it could be a student, it could be a business. Mm-hmm. And I had been pretty determined to keep that be the case, to keep that as the case. And actually my founding team and some early employees and early investors actually were pretty convinced that we should pivot to the enterprise. So I was the, you know, one of the slower ones to kind of picking up on why that was going to be so important. And we had done some business model pivots and tried different approaches of how we could monetize the product. But eventually, you know, kind of we all came to our senses, and me in particular, where what we sort of discovered was over time in the consumer part of the market, consumer storage would be heavily commoditized, because as the price of storage dropped, then big incumbent technology providers should want to give it away for free. Because right. It keeps you in their ecosystem, in their orbit. Whereas right. In the enterprise market, you know, there's a lot more value that we could build up over time in advanced security and workflow technology and really, you know, sort of there's lots more range of motion to where we could pivot and build more value. So we decided to pivot the company. And then ultimately, you know, that was a pretty key decision. Because effectively everything kind of that we had anticipated did play out in the consumer part of the market. But it was a tough call, and it was certainly a make or break decision. It was very much, you know, one of those burn the boats, looking back once we made that call. But it was obviously sort of fundamental to our survival. And so, you know, lots of those, you know, probably a couple dozen of those in the first couple of years of building the business. And so, you know, I think having a founding team that you're super passionate to be able to work with, going after a problem that you're really excited to go and pursue, because you're going to have to get through just an incredible amount of difficult, you know, periods, and then obviously having a lot of conviction on whatever your vision is, are some, you know, pretty fundamental things that I think every founder needs to be able to have.
How do you? I mean, you have a co-founder that's with you 18 years later. I mean, I'm trying to think of another Silicon Valley company that's actually played out. How do you do it? I mean, I guess you guys must really love each other.
Well, we have a pretty unusual story that is sort of like hard to replicate. We all grew up together. We actually have two other founders. We all grew up together in Seattle. So we went to middle school and high school together, and we had tried lots of startup ideas. And then we went off to college, and we sort of all rejoined forces in you know, succession to build Box. And while two of the founders have since left, they were here for about 12 years or so. My sort of first co-founder, Dylan, who's our CFO, has been with us been with me the whole time. And you know, I think there's just an important dynamic of having we have a long lasting friendship where we've done lots of projects together, built you know, a variety of ideas up. This was the one that happened to work. I think it's really, if you can get it, it's amazing to be able to work with a founder that long. We know each other's weaknesses. We know each other's sort of blind spots. We debate all day long on every single, you know, decision. But there's a deep rooted, you know, trust and friendship that allows us, to go have really hard conversations and then, you know, very quickly minutes later, you know, move forward and we're now on to the next problem in the business. And that's, again, you know, very unique and I think is very responsible for, why we've been able to get so far, is having these kind of complementary skill sets, but with, you know, pretty different views in a variety of topics.
Maybe my next one, I'll start it with my best friend and see if I can replicate this model.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's either the worst advice or the best advice. you know, people say don't start companies with your friends or family.
I disagree with that.
And there's like lots of ways that can, you know, spectacularly, you know, blow up, and you end up in lawsuits and you're never friends again. In our case, you know, obviously we've benefited from not having that, and it's built a level of trust that it lets us go and execute, I think, super well.
So I know Andy is like itching to ask you AI questions, and Nevin wants to ask you a million other founder related questions. We had some debate about it, and I just wanted you to tell jokes.
Okay.
So we can't agree what to spend our time on, but because you're so funny. I love your Twitter. I've been a long time follower. But, you know, I'm curious, you've been at this so long. And one of the things you're known for, I don't know if this is true or not, so you can correct the rumors if it's wrong, is when Box went public, you were pretty diluted at that point. You know, didn't have, you know, as much ownership as some other companies when they went public. And I'm curious, like, we have talked a lot on this pod about, you know, should founders ask for more equity and how much does it matter? And should you fundraise and get diluted? So I'm curious, like, your take on how much that matters. You're clearly still at it. You know, would that have been different if you had had more ownership at the IPO? You know, how do you think about that? And what advice do you have for, you know, new founders?
Yeah, tough one. And unfortunately, I don't have like any like good dilution related jokes. It's very, very serious topic.
You can work on it for Twitter and or X, whatever, whatever you call it.
I'm holding on to Twitter for a while. But so you know, dilution one is really tricky. So would I love more ownership? 100%. I mean, I'd love to have as much of the company as humanly possible. You know, my ultimate calculus, and some of this is kind of, you know, hindsight and revisionist history, but I think, you know, as we went along, we always sort of made the decision of what's going to make the company much bigger. And, you know, we'd rather have a small piece of something really big than a big piece of something either smaller or that doesn't work out and be successful. And so we sort of always had that kind of mentality in terms of our ownership stake. And there were multiple junctures, you know, it's actually really interesting. There was sort of almost like two wildly different phases of our fundraising periods. Unfortunately, they both resulted in a decent amount of dilution. But the first period was we raised small amounts of money on extremely low valuations. So that was very dilutive.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was when we were working on getting traction and trying to figure out the idea. And you know, we would do crazy situations and thank God for some of our early investors and their flexibility. But we had like bridge rounds where it was just extensions of our Series A and our Series B because it was during the 08 kind of economic collapse. And so all of these things were just crazy dilutive because, you know, valuations at the time, at least for us, you know, where our Series A was a $5 million post.
right.
Yeah. That itself is a joke. I mean, that's the
thing you've said. Exactly.
But well, that's actually not the funniest thing. That was our Series A. Our seed round, our very first seed round was a $240,000 post. So, or maybe anything.
That's better. Yes. That's better.
I actually know that was pre. Sorry. It was 320 post. We raised $80,000 on 320 post. We sold a quarter of the company for $80,000. So, like that is a good joke. So
that's great.
So like we had basically two eras. One era was extremely dilutive, low valuation, low capital rounds. Build out traction, figure out where we wanted to go as a business. And then we actually got traction. We sort of entered more of this hyperscale mode. But this was also then around this period where, you know, Ben Horowitz, I think, famously wrote this post of sort of the fat startup as opposed to the lean startup and this idea of like big fast, like whoever has the most sales reps and scales the fastest will win their market. We were big believers in that. We didn't, I mean, necessarily need the post to kind of prove the point, but our you know, theory was very clear, which is like if you're in this window of hyper growth, you want as many customers as you can get because that's just a recurring revenue stream that can last forever once you can get those customers in at least the enterprise market. So then we flipped where we raised large amounts of money on fortunately higher valuation, but still, you know, each funding round was 10 or 15% dilution at that stage because maybe it was, you know, 100 million on a billion or something. And so in both periods, these were pretty dilutive periods. We went into both periods pretty eyes wide open. I don't think we kind of like realized like, okay, you know, if you add all of these founding rounds up, how much dilution is that going to be? But we certainly at each decision point realized that by embarking on that next round, it would open up and unlock a much bigger opportunity for us, or it would mean our survival, depending on, again, which stage we were at. So it's one of these things, which is like, I'd love more ownership. At the same time, each of those funding rounds were done, I think, for an important reason to help us either survive or scale. And that's sort of the trade, which is, you know, I could complain about it, but each of those rounds allowed us to achieve or build a bigger business. And so I don't really like, it's kind of, you know, you can kind of get mad of like, okay, well, you know, I was only 22. Should I have been able to raise it at a higher valuation? Sure. But you know, there's like a lot of things that happened like that. So I think my advice, you know, there's probably not too many things that I would have been able to do that differently because of the economic environment at the time with valuations. The good news is it's pretty unlikely that any founder would have my story today. I mean, your angel round would not be done at $320,000 post. Really, like you should you know, call this podcast if you're doing a round like so that should not happen. But I think, you know, fortunately valuations have come up. So your dilution events, should be, you know, both less frequent and less impactful. And I think you just, I mean, ultimately I would always optimize for the scale of the business versus the scale of your ownership. But I think there's around the margins ways to at least be thoughtful. Like if you can invest more in, not invest dollars, but invest your energy and focus into getting cash flow earlier, you'll be less dependent on external funding. So the more control you can have of your startup destiny, the better off you'll be. The less you'll need to raise, or the less frequently you raise, or the more leverage you'll have when you raise. These are kind of like obvious things, but they end up mattering a ton, which is like, if you are in a position where you literally don't have to raise money, you will always then be in control of how much ownership you have. And in our case, again, we were rarely in control because we were trying to grow so fast, which meant our burn rate was so high, which meant we had to raise more capital, which meant we had to get more dilution. Again, still happy about all those decisions, but you as any founder could at least put yourself in a position where you have a little bit more control of which path you go down. So again, profitability, free, you know, cash flow, being more kind of cognizant of how many, you know, venture rounds you want to do. These are all at least, you know, factors on the margin you can control for.
And also just to like, what type of company are you actually building? Like, are you building like a SaaS company? Are you building a hardware company? Like, are you building a marketplace? Like, I think all of these different things that, they all require different types of funding. And I think just for the listeners, I don't know if you have anything to say on that, Aaron, but like, I think that it's all different, obviously.
Yeah, I think 100%. I think the one thing I would sort of caution and be thoughtful of, and I don't really see early stage founders think about this enough, as much as I'd like them to think about it, probably.
Yeah.
Is thinking about the margin of your business model.
Yes.
I think we kind of, you know, and I mean, founders are great because we're kind of all like naively, like, you know, like all markets are the same, all opportunities are the same, all business models are the same. Like if you can solve a problem for a customer, go after it full force. But like, not all business models are the same. Not all opportunities are the same. Not all margin structures are the same. And, you know, there are, unfortunately, you know, businesses out there still getting started to this day where you kind of look at it and you're like, even in the best of all scenarios, you know, you're not going to be able to get a 60, 70, 80% gross margin business out of this. It's always going to be a 10 or 20 or 30% gross margin business. And then if you work backwards from any business that's a 10, 20, 30, 40% gross margin business, you have to run that type of operation so differently than kind of a classic software company. Like there's no room for any degree of any margin of error, any discretionary investment. I mean, these, you know, if you look at how Walmart is run, just the ruthlessness you need to be able to have, that is not a SaaS company. And so you can't build, you know, you can't build a business with the margin structure of a Walmart, you know, with the tools and the methodologies of a Salesforce.com, you know, type margin business.
Right.
These are just entirely different models. And so I do think that sometimes, you know, we get into this trap of building these businesses where, like, even again, at the end of the rainbow, the margin structure won't support, you know, the opportunity or the way that you're thinking about, you know, the funding and kind of going after it. So, or what you're building up operationally or the team. or subsidizing, you know, various parts of the business model, or how expensive it is to acquire customers. Like, all those things ultimately need to correlate to the margin structure of the company.
Maybe I'll tee this up, and this will be Andy's segment on AI, but I'll actually just tee this up on, like, what do you ultimately think, like, the gross margin structure for a lot of these AI companies are, potentially, or today, or potentially going to be? And then Andy can ask all of his AI questions that have been burning to ask you.
This is right where I wanted to go.
Oh, cool.
I agree.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the one challenge is, like, you know, AI companies are very all encompassing as a concept now at this point. So I mean, just at a minimum, if you just say sort of the AI model developers and kind of training, you know, companies, and then versus maybe the application, you know, end user applications, I'm not particularly bullish on the AI models themselves, because. A friend sort of had this line that I didn't totally understand, like, 16 months ago. Now I think I understand it, like, a little at a deeper level. He basically said there's no secrets in AI. And there's sort of two big reasons. One is, so much gets done in research papers, and then there's so much talent sort of mobility in AI. And so kind of what that means, if you think about it, is within any kind of 12 or 24 month period, you know, like, state of the art kind of converges across multiple of the players. And so anytime you have that in a product where it's, like, relatively fungible, and obviously, like, you know, underscore the word relatively in this case, you end up competing out profits, because if I can build a model that can spit out text at the same quality as another player, and we both have full access to the talent that can do it, and the training runs that can do it, and the research that can do it, then I'm going to try and lower my price. You're going to lower your price. I'm going to lower my price. And then we're going to, you know, end up in a margin structure that doesn't produce a lot of, a lot of extra excess profitability, because there's going to be different competing interests. So Facebook can give away the whole thing. Google maybe wants to price it at almost zero because it keeps you locked into their ecosystem. Like, there's so many different reasons why, by basically the profit goes to, you know, very, very small numbers in that part of the ecosystem. So I think the VC dollars that are chasing those companies, it's tough to figure out how you get, like, big returns, because I don't know how you get 70% gross margin on something that is, you know, again, kind of become standard in the industry. The application developers, I would just say they should look like SaaS, you know, type businesses. Where I don't know is sort of who wins and loses, and who gets, you know, who's able to fully take advantage of that. Because, you know, frankly, it's right now it's a situation where a lot of the incumbents are really well positioned to taking advantage of AI. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not seeing yet too many scenarios where AI is sort of disrupting a software incumbent. I'm seeing where AI could disrupt a non-software incumbent, where maybe you have a services business or some other kind of, type operation where AI can replace more of the human aspects of that, you know, that particular business model. But, you know, I think in a lot of cases, the incumbents in this market are well suited to leverage AI, in their product. So if you're a CRM or an HR or an ERP system, you know, already with customers, already with the workflows, AI kind of slots in pretty nicely, versus, you know, being able to, you know, back in the day, we could all build companies where we could just do, like, the cloud version of the on-prem company.
Right.
And it was such a big shift for the on-prem company to move to the cloud that you had this window of opportunity where it was disruptive. Well, now all the cloud companies, they're already in the cloud. Their applications are already well-suited for AI. The data is already in the cloud. The workflows are in the cloud. And AI just, again, kind of helps increase the value proposition of those incumbent technologies. So I think there's going to be thousands of great startups, but they probably won't be disrupting Salesforce. Or ServiceNow or Workday. They'll probably be doing things that those products didn't previously kind of go after.
So SaaS brought into this.
Just 4 minutes just for Aaron, or now 3 minutes.
I can go 5 minutes after.
Okay, great.
All right, cool. So SaaS brought into this business model, you pay per seat. So now we're starting to look like software is usage-based. Where do we go? How do you price if you're starting a software company today? I mean, everyone expects you to pay on a per-seat basis.
Yeah, I've above my pay grade. I think we have to see where the market lands on this one. I agree. There's so many different pricing models that are being thrown around. There's obviously like per unit, token, transaction, there's seed. There's sort of like, you know, can I charge you a percentage of the OPEX that I saved you? So there's like, I probably, if anything, you know, we're gonna end up in a situation where it's just kind of all the business models work. Because it'll be dependent mm-hmm. on what particular part of the space you're going after. Like if I go to you and I'm like helping augment or replace like your call center, maybe I could actually just say, okay, you used to spend $20 million and I'm going to run this at a tenth of the price. So you're going to pay me $2 million, you know, almost like, you know, in a way that's unrelated to what how many seats or tokens or whatever that relates to. It's just like, I'm going to be 90%, you know, cheaper. And that model will work for some companies. But I think it's way too early to know kind of where the business model lands in the space, I think.
Yeah, no, labor augmentation is basically what everyone at the end of the day is selling.
Yeah, I think that is going to be the biggest play in AI. So
turn it back to you, Kevin.
Yeah, what do you think? I love your commentary on all things blockchain and everything token based and NFT based. Do you think that goes anywhere now? Like, obviously, like every like technology cycle goes through their hype cycle, and we've all seen the graph, and like, do you think that there is anything that people can actually build, like, that is okay?
Yeah, Aaron should credit, because he was like he called out all the Web3 insanity, and
I have been talking shit with you.
Call it out as insanity. And he was like, you know, one of the few leaders that was like, I think this is a little overblown.
So mostly I was just trying to make it so we didn't get so crazy that customers would come to us and say, hey, where's your blockchain thing? So I probably would have, honestly, I would not have ever even cared up until Web3 sort of terminology. Like when it was just crypto or even Bitcoin, like I have plenty of friends that are obviously incredibly bullish on Bitcoin. To me, it's just, okay, if you want to believe in a digital gold, I don't mind. Like, it's fine. People have their passions. I had a friend who was a gold, like he was like a gold miner in, you know, and like, 15 years ago, and you know, didn't interest me that he collected gold, but that right. was like a really interesting thing. So I mean, Bitcoin, if people want to all establish, you know, Bitcoin as a digital gold, that makes sense. The issue that I had was people started talking about, you know, Web3 as if it was, some kind of
the new mobile
to Web2 yeah. or like the new mobile or,
yeah.
you know, a real platform shift. And it just, you know, didn't stand to reason that was the case. In terms of how the technology actually worked in practice. So I don't think it'll come back, only because it had nothing to do with the hype cycle or the bubble. Like, it just technically can't deliver.
I agree.
What people want. I mean, even if literally this thing was, you know, 0 cents and there was no NFTs and anything, you still would not put your data on a blockchain for any kind of real, you know, at scale application that you know, any of our parents would use or something. So it's just
gaming NFTs. Come on.
I got totally convinced for like a couple of weeks that, okay, maybe that could work or these things. But then you just kind of always go back to like, okay, just APIs do all these things. And then you don't need to
totally
and
agree.
You don't need to worry about people having crypto wallets and like, it doesn't increase the portability, because some other game developer still has to support whatever that standard is. And so once you've done all that work, you could have just had a normal, you know, web app or web service with an API. So I don't think it's going to come back in the fashion that we had seen it 2 years ago. Does crypto survive? You know, sure, because it's clearly Bitcoin's not going anywhere. But I do think it's going to be a pretty different environment than you know, what some had anticipated.
Do you think that there is like an actual like cheaper alternative, like internet currency, like versus everybody paying by credit card? Like obviously there's ACH. I'm a B2B business, so we accept credit card, but we charge extra for it. We also accept ACH, and it's like a 30-cent fee or something like that. Do you think that there's going to be, and I know like David Marcus is working on something, like he spun up from Facebook, and Solana has something like this. Do you think that there should be, or could there be a cheaper, basically MasterCard or Visa that doesn't take the 2.9% that we all pay?
I guess if you like, you know, whiteboarded it out, you know, you could get there, but like, you know, the every time you start to add back in all of the reasons why we have all the centralized platforms,
yeah,
you add back in, you know, more or less a similar amount of all those costs. Like, I don't want to be able to send, you know, a transaction to the wrong address and then never get my money back. If I make that mistake, whereas I can call a bank and have them undo that transaction, or you know, there's some fraud prevention team. So it's just like, once you add back all of that, that's sort of why we have, you know, the 1% fee and all these things. And so
yeah. In
you know, in 50 years from now, is it possible 100%? I would just, my bet would be more on, you know, Apple doing this all within platform, or Google doing it all within platform, and you know, we can trade money, you know, with zero fees, because it's just a database row change on their end. Like, I would anticipate that's a more logical solution than us, you know, having a trustless transaction that we can never unwind. And you know, the moment I lose one set of keys, I lose all my money. Like, right. That's like, you know, doesn't seem like the future.
I agree. Do you want to end? I think Aaron has to leave here. Do you want to end on for our listeners? So like our listeners are first time founders on any, maybe it's a comic relief or some other wise wisdom that you have as we kind of say goodbye to you here.
Well, I don't want to end on crypto. So so whatever, I'm happy to take any other final topics, Andy. Yeah.
Would you do it again? So, I mean, I think you saw NVIDIA's CEO was asked this famous question. So you're 18 years in. Yeah. So would you do it again? And what would you do?
I would do it again. And Jensen's answer was what is like very deep. Like, you got to like unpeel the onion like five layers to like deeply understand like his whole point. Because I think his actual underlying thing was he literally personally would do it again, but it was a conveying of like how freaking hard the whole thing was, and there's no alternative for him, you know, in terms of what he gets passionate about. And and that's generally my view, which is that it's super hard. Obviously you cut your teeth on just, you know, all day long, and you're working 24/7. I can't see an alternative that I would be excited to do. I tried. I was an intern a couple times, and I'm like the worst employee, probably like from just like an IC standpoint. And so like I could never have survived in a real organization. Like one performance review cycle, they would have pipped me out. So this was the only.
Like, you would be able to get a job that was a little bit better than IC.
No, seriously. I was so bad. I was so bad.
I mean, now.
Oh, now? Okay. So
you could probably find something else.
I think I literally would make it to like the half year review cycle, and then they would be like, it's not working out. I don't see how. So this is the only thing I could do. And I'm super.
Look,
I'm,
if you I'm, ever want to take over as CEO of Winnie, that job is open and available.
Oh, I'm down for other CEO gigs. So I'm happy.
She's
to
offered her. This to everyone.
You know, no, she's offered.
I mean, I could use a different industry for.
You just added on just a little slide. Senior getting go for it.
No, I'm too into files. That's the weird part. I love files. so if you guys get into document management, let me know. But so this is what I love doing. I wouldn't do anything differently. And I would, you know, certainly if tomorrow I wasn't, you know, at Box, I'd have to just try again, doing it again. So it's you know, I think as we all know, it's hard to get this much fulfillment from anything else. And it's a crazy life that we've chosen, but it is, there's nothing like it. So yeah, I mean, my final call out would just be, I think the key is to do something that you're super passionate about. And you know, it's interesting, the crypto thing, maybe just to tie back to that, or even AI, frankly, I do think you have these waves where there's a really exciting kind of moment in time in a technology market. And a lot of people go after and sort of chase opportunities in those markets. And the problem is the hype will always come down. The bubble will always burst. It'll always be uncool to do the category that previously was cool. So you kind of really have to care about what you're doing. You have to find a way to have sustained, you know, kind of passion about whatever that particular product is, or else, you know, it's hard to then outlast the 3 to 5 year, you know, kind of window where maybe there is some hype in your category.
Right.
To the 10 year, you know, window, which is, you know, ultimately how you build something sustaining. I got super lucky. Like, it's not like I like inherently cared about files, but we got really passionate about what we actually can do for enterprises.
Right.
And that's allowed us to kind of outlive, you know, hype cycles over the years in and around, you know, parts of categories that we play in. Ultimately, I think for any founder, you have to do something that you're truly passionate about, and hopefully people can find that organically, because it's super awesome if you land on it.
Well, thanks so much, Aaron.
Yeah,
this
thanks.
Has been
Thank
great.
You.
As
this
long
awesome.
As you press leave and let it upload 100%, we are all good.
Okay.
We're going to continue on, but thank you so much for your time.
Great.
Thank
all right.
you.
All right. Thanks, folks. See ya.
Bye. All right. Aaron has left the building.
That was great.
That was awesome.
A very educational, even
18 years on the same thing.
Yeah. I looked at his Crunchbase and it said.
You can do math, Kevin. Because if he started in 2006 and it's 2024, I mean, that's 18.
Oh, I must
and we
listen
have
to something
an
different.
MIT math major here talking to
no,
us.
No, I minor.
No, no, she's a CS major.
Maybe in computer science. I
come on,
only the minor.
Learn your host. Learn your host. Come on. So what are we going to want to talk about for the rest of the 20 minutes that we got here? I think that was an amazing episode. I think that one thing like that I brought up initially that I think that it doesn't really exist anymore in Silicon Valley. It used to, like, when I was in the hype cycle, I was able to get time with Travis from Uber and Brian from Airbnb and also Aaron. That's how we got him on the show and Drew from Dropbox. It's too bad that I don't think that exists anymore outside of what you pointed out, Andy, through intro. So it's kind of sad maybe we move to this digital
exist.
World. Does it? You think so? I think that it's more subgroups. I think that like our group that we have, like our WhatsApp group, is like one of the most like important groups, and what I learn more about everything from. But it just doesn't exist like at that. Like, I was talking to Brian Chesky when he was at the height. And he was talking to me and he was getting like weekly meetings with me. Like, that doesn't happen, man. It just doesn't anymore.
I think it does. I've never felt like there's nobody I can't meet with. I've been very impressed, and I'm not going to name names here, with the people who meet with me on a weekly or a monthly basis.
Come on, I didn't name names.
It's not appropriate. I don't know that they want me to say who I meet with. But I meet with some very impressive people who are billionaires in tech, and they always make time for me. I think
there's just like a little bit of a different bar now because there's such a proliferation of founders.
That's true.
Meet with people, but I do have to limit it because it could just be kind of like insanity. I could spend all my day just like mentoring people, but I have a company to run. So I usually kind of require that they've hit a certain level of success. Or there's like other people that can mentor them, you know, that are closer to the stage they're at and not like 8 years into building a business. And they can listen to the pod if they really want to hear from me. So I
think book you on intro.
You can't, like, as a brand new founder, you can't aim for Brian Chesky, but like you can aim for someone who's raised their seed round or their Series A, and like vice versa. I feel like I could probably call up a lot of people who have, you know, successfully sold a business or, you know, raised like Series C and beyond. But can I like go knock on the door of like massive, you know, Mark Zuckerberg? Like, no, I need like more of a connection there. And it's just like, it's just the fact of the matter, there's so many more founders now, and it's actually a great point. So much easier to start a company, which is a great thing, but like you just have to, you know, every CEO running a business has to be a little more selective about who they meet with. And like, you have to be more thoughtful about like who you ask for their time.
I think that I'm being maybe a little nostalgic as far as like when I started my first company, but you're completely right. And also just like look at the past 50 episodes that we've had on this podcast, and like what we're trying to do is trying to share that knowledge. And we've had other billionaires on here other really famous founders that have shared their war stories and all that stuff. And so I think you're right. There's a lot more of that content
out there now too.
So meeting
with someone to be like, what was the hardest part of founding a company? Like, just look on the internet.
That's gone.
And you really should be meeting with people in your industry that have specific knowledge.
But the only thing you don't get, I will say this, like you don't get the real stuff. So obviously, like Aaron was like as transparent as he can be, but he's a public company CEO. He's not going to give you the real details. Like when I asked him, like, what were the hardest points in your company? He's not going to say like,
today and our stock is about
like, no, well, to be clear, Box is doing amazing. So let's not say that.
He can't tell us if they're about to not be doing amazing because.
And also through us, and one of the questions that was kind of posed in the group channel was like, what is the worst VC to invest with? And like, he can't answer that. There's no way. And so that's what you get on like a personal to personal level. And that could be also like, Sarah plug, YPO or plug, the Hamptons that is started by
like, if you're looking for a CEO membership group and you are like at a certain stage in your business where you've reached a certain level of success, like there is nothing that compares to YPO. Like none of these new, they're all trying to be what YPO has been for many years.
I'm just trying to throw a bone. Like, Sam,
are you an investor in Hampton? Is that what you're doing? You're pushing your book here?
Sam's actually an investor in us. So
I'll
put that out there.
I like that there's other networks because not every business can get to YPO. So there's like Chief for women, and you don't have to be a CEO to be in that. But like, if you are a CEO and like you have reached the milestones to be a member of YPO, like highly recommend you just join the real thing.
What are those milestones? Let everybody know.
So like, it's on their website. It depends on like if you so first of all, you have to be, it's Young Presidents Organization, so you have to be under 50. You have to have either 50 full-time employees or 15 employees and at least $2.5 million in annual employee compensation. You have to have a certain amount of revenue or a certain amount of enterprise value. So if you're, you know, like a venture-backed company that maybe doesn't have a ton of revenue yet, but you've been valued really high, that could count.
How do you use YPO for anybody else listening here?
I mean, for me, it is that like network where people get really real and share like the stuff that they wouldn't share on a podcast. And because it, you know, has such strict membership requirements, like it's everyone that's reached a certain level of success and is actively operating a company right now. So it's very like real time. Like this isn't dated advice of, you know, what it was like 15 years ago. And I do feel like people share stuff that, you know, what investors to avoid, what, you know, that kind of stuff that you would not ever share outside this like super confidential group.
Right. Got it. Okay. So for the remaining 10 minutes that we have, what are some, let's go to Andy here. I know you have a lot of AI related news. It's probably happened since our last podcast with Seeky. What do you got? Like, what's the latest?
Oh man, you just put me on the spot. What's new in AI? I don't know. I think everyone's eagerly waiting for GPT-5. I think what I'm waiting for is I bought a Vision Pro. So I'm waiting.
$3,500.
I bought a $3,500 Vision Pro, and I am proud to say
I get it. One. Like, or is it too late now?
Can get one a week later, basically, or you can go to the Apple Store and I guess the Burlingame Mall. Is that where there is one?
On Burlingame Ave. There's no
Burlingame Avenue near Starbucks. Yes, I forgot.
So, yeah.
What is the Vision Pro? What are you most excited about that it does?
That's the funny part is I'm not even sure. What I'm excited about is the fact that I have a piece of hardware made by Apple with a bunch of cool stuff, and I hope it's going to be amazing. And if not, I'm going to return it.
Can I wear glasses and get it or no?
Yes. So if you wear glasses, they take your prescription and they customize the lenses for you.
Oh, so I got to figure out what my prescription is before I place an order.
You have to upload your prescription, Sarah.
One question, Andy. Like, after you use it two or three times, like, is there, a recycling place you take it to? Like, how does that work?
Well, if I don't want to use it after, like, 3 days, I'm going to return it because Apple has, like, a 14 or 30-day return policy. So let's start there. Second, there's this place called eBay.
That's what I'm asking. Yes? Okay.
Second, there's this place...
When are you getting yours? And can you tell us then if it's good and we could just get one then?
February 2nd.
Okay, great. So,
I will tell you. Yeah. My expectation is very high. I mean, the keynote, the videos they've been putting out, you have a 100-inch screen in front of you at all times. You can see through it. So it's not VR. It's augmented reality. For a plane, it looks like the greatest thing ever. So
for a plane it does.
And look at any screen on a plane.
Oh, interesting. This is probably not for you on a plane.
Oh, damn. If that's the use case, I'm screwed. I can't do anything on a plane, a car, a boat, something.
I'm curious what it's gonna be like to work all day on it. So I mean
All day on it? Are you insane?
I'm
what
gonna
are you
use
doing?
It for 3 or 4 hours.
Sales calls with that.
You're going to have an avatar. It's going to be a great talking point. And I mean, you're going to have a Zoom.
You're not going to have an avatar. Are you kidding me?
Have you seen it? That's what they literally... It scans a lifelike avatar of you.
And creates it. Just wait till you get yours and then we try it out on this.
Agreed.
Pod, and we see...
Knowing it's Riverside, it's probably not going to work with this, just to be totally clear.
I think that we're done with topics because we had everything like around Aaron coming on. We were very excited to have him on. Why don't we end the pod early unless you guys have any other things to add?
Got to go back to grinding, man.
We're going back to grinding. So
I'm good.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Like, subscribe, whatever platform you are on. Thank you for listening. And go try Box. He
if
didn't.
You're an enterprise.
Yeah, if you're an enterprise, go try Box. And we will see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.